We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the show, Harriet Williamson. At the controls hour one this morning, we had Kyle Mabry, and Jason Croft is there now. This year, this program, Focus, turns 30. We first went on the air on February 2nd. Of 1981. And as part of the celebration for our birthday, we're digging into what we are calling the Deep Archives to rebroadcast some interviews that have not been heard in many years. And we'll be playing portions of these interviews featuring some well-known guests speaking on topics that we think are as important today, in some cases as controversial today, as they were 20 years ago. And we thought that we would start with two shows that explored environmental issues, one on the global scale and something that was a little bit more personal, sort of on the backyard scale. And there is probably no single person who is more closely associated with the debate over global climate change than Al Gore. He raised that issue when he was running for the presidency back in 1988 and really helped to start a national discussion on the issue with his very first book, Earth in the Balance, a book that was written and published when he was still in the U.S. Senate representing the state of Tennessee. So here is some of a conversation that we had with Al Gore on March 5th of 1992. This was just after the book came out. The subtitle of his book is Ecology and the Human Spirit, and those were two things that clearly Gore felt were connected.
Part of the healing process our civilization has to go through involves reintegrating the personal with the political. We have adopted this scientific worldview for the last few centuries that objectifies everything in the world, and yet we have to understand things within the context of our own individual lives. And I personally believe that at bottom, this ecological crisis is a spiritual crisis involving our relationship, each of us, to the earth itself and to the physical world. And I find that individuals all over this country and all over the world really are reexamining some of these issues. And they're seeing signs of change in their own personal lives. And it's hard to look at the thermometer and see that the last 2 years were the hottest 2 years in recorded history and really find much significance in that, because in an individual's lifetime there's a normal fluctuation, you know, and not just in the weather but in events generally. How do you interpret change? But more and more people are seeing the pattern. A very big change in the environment, in our civilization, in our culture. And I think people feel in their bones that we have to make some major changes. At least that's what I'm hearing. Mm.
I'm interested in having you talk some more about this idea of environmentalism of the spirit that you referred to in the book, something that you would hope that we could cultivate in people. What exactly does that mean, environmentalism of spirit?
Well, I think that our civilization faces a crisis of meaning. I think people wonder whether their lives have as much meaning as they would like. We see these posters that are intended to be funny that say, "He who dies with the most toys wins." And modern culture emphasizes consumption and activity out in the world without much attention to what's really most important in life. And I think that people find it a little odd that they don't, in some cases, know their neighbors. They stay in their automobiles and go from the car to the front door and the kind of community involvement that we used to have seems to be missing in so many communities around the country. I think people find it odd that we as a nation are content to borrow $1 billion a day and not worry about the impact on our children. It's as if we're not connected to either the communities in which we live or the generations that will follow us. And I think that in order to heal the ecological crisis, we have to look at the lack of connection between our individual lives and the larger web of relationships from family to community to nation to what is now a global civilization. And in an even more basic way, I think that the rhythms of modern civilization have led to a kind of alienation from the earth itself, whereas people used to be close to the land, and during the agricultural era were in tune with the seasons. Now there's an artificial quality to the industrial civilization in which we live that I think has created a spiritual crisis, and I think, well, what I mean by the phrase environmentalism of the spirit is an effort to rebuild that sense of connection to the natural world.
Mm-hmm. We're certainly at a time now when perhaps the single issue that's on people's minds is the economy and economic conditions, and there are certainly a lot of people that are facing very difficult times. And I think if we went out and did a survey, we went out on the street and asked people if they supported protection of the environment, of course they'll say yes. The difficulty is that when it gets to look like it's going to cost them something, then they're going to start thinking about it again. So that sort of makes you wonder, well, are they really telling you the truth when they say they're concerned about the environment? Or is the depth of their concern that shallow? Or is it that they simply feel that they have to place other concerns first? And, you know, what do we do about that?
Well, I think some people still believe the outdated assumption that we have to choose between a healthy environment and a healthy economy. And if you believe that is a choice that we have to make, then in times of recession, you feel like you have to relegate environmental stewardship to second place. But more and more people are finding that that's a false choice. It's ironic, for example, that those nations with the worst economies always seem to have the most devastated environments. And those companies that choose a commitment to environmental protection so often see their profits and productivity go up. In fact, waste in the form of pollution is economic waste, and the careful attention necessary to eliminate harmful environmental impacts, ends up producing greater efficiency in every industrial operation or business.
We're talking this morning with Senator Al Gore. He represents the state of Tennessee in the U.S. Senate. We're talking about environmental policy, and you can read about some of his thinking if you take a look at his recently published book, Earth in the Balance, Ecology and the Human Spirit. Our next caller here is line number 3. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm. I like what I've heard so far, but I wanted to raise a little different issue here. Concerning coal and oil-fired power plants.
Right.
I've read somewhere that the carcinogens and other soot that is spewed forth from these power plants probably contributes to about over 70,000 premature deaths around the world, or maybe it's just the United States. And if you could contrast that to perhaps the nuclear power industry, which I don't think has that type of record of people dying either directly or even indirectly. And also, is it true that they have a technology for nuclear power where they can take the toxic waste and mix it with sand and thereby make it into a rather inert material?
I don't think they yet have a a technology for disposing of nuclear waste that is satisfactory, nor do they have a location for disposing of it that is satisfactory. It all depends upon what level of risk we are willing to accept for future generations. I don't rule out the possibility that research will provide us both an acceptable form of waste disposal and a new generation of passively safe, standardized reactors that have a level of risk that's acceptable to the American people. But the current generation of nuclear reactors, in my opinion, represents a technological dead end. The utility industry has come to the same conclusion, and as a result, there have been no new orders for reactors in almost 15 years, and that's an economic decision as much as a safety decision. I think we ought to emphasize the conservation and efficiency, the use of microprocessors in every engine and furnace, and new design approaches, new sources of renewable energy, and continue research to see whether or not these problems with nuclear power might be solved in the future.
Do you consider the current coal and oil generators to be acceptable in their safety?
Well, no, I don't. No, I certainly don't. And your point that we have underreacted to the environmental consequences of burning oil and coal is a point I certainly share. And in fact, in Earth in the Balance, I spend a great deal of time pointing out exactly what the environmental problems are worldwide associated with the burning of fossil fuels. We are changing the amount of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere by 100%. And in the process, we are changing the amount of heat from the sun that is trapped in the Earth's atmosphere, and that in turn is changing the pattern of global climate. I don't think it's an accident that 8 of the 10 hottest years in recorded history have been in the last 12 years, or that this was the hottest winter in recorded history, the winter we've just been through. So, yes, I agree with you that the environmental consequences of fossil fuels must be reexamined.
Okay. I just wanted to get off the phone and make one little last comment about your idea of spiritual environmentalism or whatever, and just applaud you and your wife's efforts against pornography. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
We're here at the point where we're getting sort of close to the end, and I have a couple of other people that I want to try to include. But, you know, at the beginning of the program, I mentioned the fact that part of the book outlined what you called the Global Marshall Plan.
Yeah.
And you really already talked about one of the points, and that is to try and design a new way of thinking about productivity that also reflects economic cost.
Right.
And I obviously we can't discuss all of this in great depth, but I wonder if you might want to talk about one or two of the most important points, additional points, that are part of this global strategy that you talk about.
Yes, I'd love to. I think the effort to save the Earth's environment must become the central organizing principle for the post-Cold War world. In the last 50 years, the organizing principle for Western democracies has been the defeat of communism, so that the Interstate Highway Bill passed as the Defense Interstate Highway Bill, and federal aid to education passed in direct response to the Russians launching Sputnik. In the same way, an effort to make the saving of the Earth's environment the new central organizing principle in the aftermath of communism's collapse will make it possible to gain support for widely disparate efforts that come together in a coherent purpose, saving the Earth's environment. For example, a strategic goal of stabilizing world population by making birth control more available, safe birth control more available on a voluntary basis, by lifting child survival rates so that parents in these developing countries have more confidence that their children will survive and thus have smaller family sizes, as research shows will occur, and lifting the level of literacy and education so that women are empowered to take part in those choices. I think we also need a strategic global effort. I call it the Strategic Environment Initiative, to accelerate the development of new technologies that allow economic progress without environmental destruction. Technologies like better forms of solar energy, more efficient techniques for conservation. We know what a lot of these technologies are, but we need to accelerate their development and then make them available to these countries that are desperately trying to achieve some measure of economic progress and don't really want to repeat the mistakes that have been made in industrial countries by fouling their environment. I think we need a whole new generation of treaties and covenants like the ones that are being negotiated for the Earth Summit this June in Brazil, and I think we need a new effort at global environmental education as well. Those are just a few of the strategic goals that I would make a part of a global Marshall Plan funded by Japanese and European wealth and U.S. leadership.
Very good. Let's talk with someone else. Line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. A lot of spinning thoughts here. The conversation's really interesting. I had a specific question that sort of dovetails into what you were just talking about in terms of productivity versus environmental cost. And it has a lot to do with automobiles in the United States, which I think are one of our biggest polluting sources, and CAFE standards. And wanted to know what the senator felt about recent, what I think are movements toward cases involving the General Motors Corporation and small car advocates in terms of safety,
yeah.
And whether or not in the book there's any projections about safety versus energy efficiency. Read an interesting article in Popular Science yesterday about the Japanese being one of the most energy efficient societies on the planet right now, and you can talk a lot about social costs, but just make that as a note. I'm wondering where our models are supposed to come from. You know, you've used the phrase the aftermath of the communist collapse several times today, and I think that I don't think the capitalistic system has proven that it can handle a lot of these loads any better than any other system can right now. And I guess I'll point out the General Motors Corporation as something to question returning to that. And where is the model, and what can you tell me about where we are with CAFE right now in terms of corporate average fuel economy and where you think we need to be? And I appreciate the conversation.
Well, I think we need to push those standards aggressively. We're arguing with Detroit about whether or not they can make a car fleet that gets 25 miles per gallon. And Honda just announced a mid-size car, not a small car, but a mid-size car that gets 55 miles per gallon with no new technology. I went to check how in the world did they do it. It turns out to be very simple. They just put microprocessors in the fuel line and the air line, and they come up with a consistently leaner mix just before the fuel goes into the carburetor. We've known for years you could mix more air with gasoline and get more bang per BTU, but now with the new information technologies, we're able to be a little more precise about how those mixtures take place. I mean, it's ridiculous to accept at face value the arguments from Detroit that we're going to have carnage on the highways and economic disaster if we get to 25 miles per gallon. It's just absurd. And if I can use that as a metaphor, David, this new technology for mixing air and gasoline more efficiently, mm-hmm. In terms of our public policy, the challenge is not to mix gasoline with air, but to mix money with intelligence. And we've got to have policies that are a little bit higher on intelligence and leaner on money so that we can get on with the task of solving these problems. You know, people know instinctively that if we just get our act together, we can solve this problem fairly swiftly, but we've got to have leadership. We've got to have the kind of personal commitment that I think people are now bringing to this task of saving the environment, especially young people, and then get on with the task.
That is Al Gore. He was talking about his book, Earth in the Balance, on our show, Focus. In that time, we called it Focus 580. This was March 5th of 1992. At the time, he was a senator representing Tennessee, and that was before he became Bill Clinton's running mate. It seems that if you look at some of the topics that came up during this conversation, that not very much has changed over the past 20 years. Most of the electricity that we use in this country is still produced by burning fossil fuels, and most of that is coal. The last nuclear plant to be completed in the U.S. went online in 1996. There is still no permanent storage site for high-level radioactive waste produced by nuclear generation of electricity. And the CAFE standard for cars, that's what we're talking about there right at the end, that's the fuel economy standards set by the government, was 27.5 miles per gallon in 1992 when we did this interview. As of last year, it was still 27.5. This year, it will be rising to 30.2. Now, surveys do show that Americans are concerned about the environment. In fact, on Earth Day last year, a Gallup poll found that 3/5 of Americans consider themselves either active or sympathetic to the environmental movement. The poll also found that 90% voluntarily recycled, 85% reduced household energy use, and 76% said that they had bought products specifically because they thought they were better for the environment. This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. This year, we are marking 30 years on the air by listening back to some of the oldest shows that we have in our archives. And these are programs that have not been heard for many years. This is something that we're planning on doing a couple of times every month, setting aside a couple of hours to do this. By the way, you can help us celebrate our 30th anniversary by sharing some of your comments about the show. Maybe you have some Focus memories. Maybe there is some particular program or guest that stands out in your mind. We'd certainly like to hear what you think about these special archives that we're doing. You can let us know any and all of that by going to the WILL website. That's will.illinois.edu. Go to the Focus page, and up at the top, you will see a place there where we're looking for your comments. We're about midway through this program. We'll take a little break here, and when we continue, you will be hearing an interview that Celeste Quinn did with environmental writer Michael Pollan back in 1991. So don't go away. This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you listening. This year, the show turns 30. And one of the things that we're doing to celebrate is to go back to some old programs that are in our archives, but shows that we have not aired in a very long time. For the first couple, we thought we'd take some shows that dealt with environmental issues. In the first hour, some conversation of global issues with Al Gore. So for this second conversation here, we'll turn from global issues to local ones. Today, Michael Pollan is an author and a journalist who is well known for his writing about food. His books include The Omnivore's Dilemma and The Botany of Desire. He was not quite so well known back in 1991 when he talked with Celeste Quinn about his very first book, Second Nature, A Gardener's Education. And they began by talking about Pollan's move to the country, his first attempts at gardening, and his battles with deer.
You know, I was a city boy moving to the country. I mean, I start this book very naive. I mean, and I had all the romantic ideas about nature, and one of those was a fence would sort of get between me and the natural world. And so I just had this instinctive suspicion of fences, and I've certainly gotten over that. I've come to greatly appreciate them.
Now, on the problem with the deer, did you really went so far as to stretch wire over the top?
Yeah, which I don't feel is I think it's a very sensible, I don't even think animal rights activists, well, I could be wrong. I mean, it was a classic electric fence, and very low wattage, so they just run off of a battery.
Uh-huh.
They give you a fairly minor shock, and they don't hurt anything.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, they have fences. I wasn't able to find one, but my plan was to get a fence that was powered by the sun. There are solar-powered ones. You have a little collector in the corner of your mm-hmm. garden, and that picks up the energy from the sun. It's just enough power to run the line. What happens with the deer, in my experience, in fact, I don't even have to leave it on anymore because they're all trained in my neighborhood, but you entice them to get to come sniff it, and they get a little shock, and then they don't come back again.
Yeah.
Because obviously the sensation of electric shock to a wild animal is kind of unprecedented. Memorable. And,
yeah.
So after one shock, they're gone forever.
Yeah.
So it was behavior modification, and there's plenty for them to eat outside of the garden, and they leave me alone right now.
Yeah.
Although every year there's a couple incursions of baby animals. rabbits.
There's a fence around our vegetable garden, and it is because otherwise, the rabbits and the squirrels and everybody else is in there. But I also think that fences keep either in the form of a hedge or the classic fence somehow keep my garden as a retreat, which is
exactly
what I want.
Oh yeah, Celeste, I totally agree. There's a very good aesthetic reason and emotional reason to have fences, and I think Americans are really missing out on something by not fencing even their front yards. If you go back to the dictionary and you look in the Oxford English Dictionary for the origin of the word garden, the etymology has the very idea of enclosure in it. It comes from old German and old English words for an enclosure. It's the key concept, I think, in a garden. It's a refuge, and it's a wall you erect against nature on one side and against society's gaze on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And when you take down that wall, you give up something, I think. You don't
mm-hmm.
have that sense of enclosure and privacy and sanctity almost.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you look in Webster's dictionary, the definition of garden doesn't even mention enclosure, just a patch of ground with some flowers and stuff growing in it.
Mm.
So Americans have really changed the concept of garden. And if you go anywhere in the world, actually, I mean, we call our gardens yards, and we think of a garden as a patch. It's a patch of flowers or vegetables. Nobody would refer to their, say you live in the suburbs and you have your normal front yard and backyard. In England, that would be called your garden. Here it's called the yard, and the garden is only those little squares or rectangles of plants that we have in them.
Yeah.
So I think that and the reason you don't call it a garden needs something around it to feel like a garden. So I'm all in favor of that. I mean, I'm one of the things I talk about a lot in the book, and perhaps we can get to later, or callers may want to address, is the whole obsession of Americans with their front lawns.
Mm-hmm.
And the ideology of the front lawn, essentially, is one of community. And we really feel it's very antisocial or anti-democratic or selfish to put any kind of barrier between our yard and our neighbor's yard. And that's really, it was a real campaign in the 1860s and 70s to force people to take down their fences.
Yeah.
And it really caught on.
We talked just a little bit about lawns. And our great love for lawns. Why do you think we are so in love with the lawn?
Well, yeah, I think our love for lawns is our great sickness with lawns. I think that the lawn is one of those is a really key American institution. I did a lot of research in the history of lawns and found that they really came in around the 1860s, 1870s, after the Civil War, when people started moving to the suburbs. I think, why are we so interested in lawns? By the way, in most other countries, the front lawn doesn't exist. I mean, it really is an American institution. It's been borrowed by a couple places with not a whole lot of success. Lawns per se, large grassy areas, do exist in a lot of places, in England in particular. But the idea of a front lawn, this unhedged space that flows from one house into another, is a very American institution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reasons for it, I think, go back to the need to unify this country. I mean, when you think about America, we are not unified by race, we're not unified by ethnic background, we're not unified by country of origin. What really holds us together, and this is the great struggle of American history, is to find out what does hold us together, but it's this land, it's the American landscape. And it's that, and the other thing is an idea, the idea of America as a special place, a new start in world history. And I think that once you've decided that the land is your common denominator, there is a lot of pressure to come up with a unified approach to it and have designed the landscape in a way that everybody can imitate. And that is why we have this very strange phenomenon. I mean, Americans don't really have a lot of distance on the lawn because we've lived with them as long as we've been alive and
yeah.
be alive today. But, we have the same landscape treatment in New England on these very glacial terrains down in Florida with the sandy soils and the desert of Southern California and the prairies of the Midwest. We all have the exact same landscape treatment.
It's something to look at.
Something to look at, and something that tells you you're in America, whether you're, mm-hmm. you're flying into Tucson or the New York metropolitan area or Seattle. You know you're in America because everybody's got lawns. And so I think that they're a way to unify us. I mean, they're, you know, I describe in the book as being a lot like television or the interstate system or fast food. I mean, it's one of these things that reaches from coast to coast, and, lets us all feel we're part of the same community. Now, that's a very nice idea on paper, but the fact is, it doesn't make sense either from an environmental or an artistic point of view. I don't think.
Yeah, I wonder if we don't love lawns in part because they're so tidy.
Yes, I think that that's definitely a big part of it.
And I think that
it's order, it's control.
Yeah. And I think that over time, our entire landscape has become very tidy.
It has. It has.
Farms, parks. Everything is very tidy.
You know, you go back to the whole idea of a grid that Thomas Jefferson came up with to cover the whole, Northwest Purchase. I mean, a good mm-hmm. part of the country is mm-hmm. and the area that you broadcast to, obviously, is covered in this grid. And it was a real effort to rationalize the land. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, this was uncharted, a lot of it, and it was very wild, a lot of it. And so coming up with a way to control it all, to give it an order, was a real... powerful motivation in American history. I mean, this was the wilderness, and mm-hmm. We needed to put our stamp on it. We needed to say, okay, this is ours now, and we're going to do something to it that is going to tie it together and express our what is really domination, I think. I think that is what, I mean, that's a big part of my beef with the lawn,
yeah.
is that it doesn't bespeak a very good relationship with nature. It is very dominating. It's not give and take.
Yeah. We're talking this morning with Michael Pollan. He's the author of Second Nature, A Gardener's Education. It's published by Atlantic Monthly Press. It's a wonderful book. It's a wonderful read if you're a gardener or not. We've got another caller waiting to talk to us. Line number two, good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Actually, I am in total agreement on everything you're saying, but I, in a way, I want to call up and defend the lawn a little bit, mostly because I did a big paper on it for Anthropology one time, and I kind of rebel against the notion of lawns just coming around lately, because I discovered when I researched my paper that the ape family prefers to sit in the grasslands and preen and pick each other, and I kind of feel like since antiquity, people have chosen grassy spots to hang around and enjoy life.
I think you're absolutely right, and
yeah.
that it goes past antiquity. I think it goes back to the African savanna.
Yeah, and you see, also something else I realized is that some lawn is really important, especially if you're trying, like, let's take child rearing, for example. You can't let your child crawl around on the forest floor unless you're willing to, like, be there to make sure they don't eat weird things, make sure ticks and bugs and everything don't bite them and stuff. Grass is a great place for a child to walk around. If you have a dog and you let them run around in the woods, you better be there to pick the ticks off them right away. Whereas if you have a lawn, there's usually less of a problem. And so lawns, in my research, kind of developed because they were, in a sense, hygienic. They were a place where you could let the kids and the pets and everything else. I mean, the pastures for the farmers have always been places where the kids and the animals went out and enjoyed outdoor games and stuff and could crawl around and stuff like that. So, well, I think you're right that we have to take some of the lawn, some of the yard has to be returned to nature. I think some of the yard ought to be lawn as well, or we're going to have lots of other problems developing over time. And that's all. I just wanted to be kind of the devil's advocate about it.
No, I think you raised some very good points. And I have to come back to a distinction I tried to make and probably didn't make clearly enough, which is between the front lawn and lawns at all. And my problem, my biggest problem is with the front lawn. Because when you think about it, we don't, you know, all the great things about lawns, that they are a wonderful place to lie around, you know, to lounge on and have your kids play on. The fact is, we don't do that in the front lawn. The front lawn is too public.
Yeah.
The lawn in most American communities is completely wasted land.
That's
the only time we go on it is to mow it.
Well, a few years ago, my neighbors in Champaign attempted to
produce kind of a wild landscape in their front yard. It started off as just ignoring the lawn, and then it wound up becoming more interested in, and they wound up getting a citation from the city for it after a while.
It's illegal not to mow your lawn in thousands of communities.
Yeah, it's hilarious in a way, but it's under, I mean, you've got somebody down the street who's trying to have a perfect lawn, and they don't want weed seeds blowing on it and everything like that. So what do you suggest is the way to get around that?
Well, I mean, I think we should have a patch of grass. I mean, I think that it should be a part of every garden. I think that, that a certain amount of grass in the backyard is excellent. Grass is a very nice way to frame gardens. In front yards, it's much more complicated. And my solution, the first point I would make is there's no one national solution. I think that is the problem with how we think about the landscape in this country. We think there should be one answer for everywhere, and that's the problem with the lawns also. The fact is, you know, the first principle of gardening is as it was put by Alexander Pope a long time ago, he said, consult the genius of the place. And what he meant is there's a correct solution for every piece of land, and it's not the same everywhere.
Your father was quite content not to have a lawn, and on the other hand, your grandfather thought quite differently. Both of those men had a very individual vision of their garden. And it seems they are not far from you and far from your thoughts when you are in your garden. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the generational link.
I think that's true for all of us. I mean, I think gardens are very much, the kind of gardens we make will have a lot to do with the kind of gardens we knew in childhood. I mean, there's always something nostalgic about gardens, I think. They're always a part of an effort to recover a place that we remember and you know, have very warm, fond memories of. In my case, however, my father was just a terrible gardener. He just didn't like to go outside. We grew up in this, this little tract house on a little sliver of land on, in the south shore of Long Island. And he did not like to mow his lawn. And I don't know whether it was laziness or contempt for his neighbors or what. I never really got to the bottom of it. But he would never mow more than, say, once a month if we and the neighbors were lucky. And gradually it became this scandal in the neighborhood. And he learned, as one of the early callers said, that your neighbors will be all over you if you don't mow your lawn. I mean, that if there's any proof that this, that your lawn is not really about just you and your land, but it's really about your community, that's it. Don't mow and you'll know what happens. It's very political. Lawns are very political. So as time went on, we became pariahs in this community. I was only 4 or 5 at the time, but I remember that there were kids that weren't allowed to play with us because we were the family that didn't mow the lawn. And all sorts of people wouldn't talk to us. Cars would slow down as they drove by and then hit the gas angrily and as they shot past. It became a big scandal, and we were pariahs. And eventually somebody in the neighborhood, that one of the last people that still talked to my parents, came over and made the pitch on behalf of the neighbors and said, look, you know the usual. You're bringing down the property values. And, it's dangerous. Knows what's growing in your lawn, etc. And my father, who had moved to the suburbs from the city and thought that, you know, here was his first house, that he could do what he wanted with his land, that was certainly one of the appeals of owning his own house in the suburbs, would have nothing of it. And his response to the neighbor was to take out the Toro, crank it up, our lawnmower, and he proceeded to mow his initials, SMP, in the front lawn. And that was it. And that was the last time he mowed, and that was his farewell to the neighbors. And we moved shortly after that, as you can well imagine. And on the other hand, on the other side, you had my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, who in fact didn't get along with my father very well. And he was a great gardener. And he lived further out on Long Island and had a garden that was big enough to feed a farm stand. And it was the neatest garden you've ever seen. You never saw a weed. Every plant had it, you know, 3 feet around it to you know, reach its own full identity, and it was cared for meticulously. And, it was just the opposite. He was an order freak, and he loved being outside. And I loved going to his garden, and that was a big influence. And I think of him a lot when I'm in the garden. He passed away a couple of years ago. So I was brought up between these two poles, and you know, one was the most charitable interpretation you could put on my father was that he was an advocate of the wilderness, although I think it came more from laziness than any conviction on his part. Mm-hmm. My grandfather was a bit of a control freak, although in the end I think he had probably a better relationship with nature than my father did.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting that you're the third generation, and you're finding a middle ground, and that's what the idea of the book is that you're trying to find that middle ground between nature and cultivation.
Yeah. I mean, I really think that, you know, it's one of the great themes in all our lives and also in American history, which is this sense that there is some kind of conflict between nature and culture, that, you know, as humans, we feel very alienated from nature, as much as we love it. Certainly, we feel that we have to control it, and that nature. That every time culture wins, nature loses, and every time nature wins, culture has to give something up. And the gardener, the reason I think gardens are so important, besides just being, you know, my love and avocation, is that gardeners have known for thousands of years that there is a way to use nature without damaging it, and in fact, there are times when the gardener improves nature, and that, to the rest of our civilization, is a very strange, radical idea. But, you know, as that last caller was saying, talking about his garden that he mulches and doesn't use any chemicals on, you know, effective gardening according to good organic principles, in fact, will take a piece of land and leave it in better condition than it was found, and that's because good gardening increases sheer amount of life on a plot of land. I mean, a good gardener's earth has got more microorganisms working and more you know, beneficial insects than a patch of unused land. They're very rich ecosystems, a good garden. There's a lot going on there.
The one thing I wanted to ask you a little bit about was roses. After reading about your meadow and the black-eyed Susans, I was surprised to read a little bit later that you had a mad infatuation going with roses, and they went from old biddies to luscious, almost forbidden flowers in the space of a couple of paragraphs in your book. What happened?
Yeah, well, that was a great experience for me, and I recounted in this long chapter about learning about roses. I had seen these catalog photographs in the Wayside Garden catalogs, and they were these antique roses, the kind of roses that were grown in Europe and in this country in the 1900s and earlier. And they didn't look anything like the rose, you know, what we think of when we think rose. I mean, we think of this modern florist shop bud, this very tight, long bud, you know, the Mr. Lincoln or one of those. I realized there was another kind of rose, and that people had come along and completely altered the rose in this century and turned it into this thing which needs an awful lot of care. I mean, if you compare it to any other plant, you know, roses need to be sprayed, and they need to be pruned, and they die all the time, and they're, you know, the most coddled, pathetic plant, I think. And but that they came out of these older roses, which were equally, you know, man-made in the sense that they were bred by breeders. They're not wild roses, but that they needed a lot less attention. And for my money, they were many, many times more beautiful. And I bought a Madame Hardy rose and one called Cuisse de Nymphe, M-U-A. It's a French rose. Maiden's Blush is the English name. And it was a revelation. And they are, frankly, I mean, the chapter is as much about sex as anything else. I mean, they are the very, very sexy roses.
Michael Pollan talking with Celeste Quinn on Focus. Back then we called it Focus 580. That was July 15th of 1991. His books included this book that they were talking about, his very first, Second Nature, A Gardener's Education, also The Omnivore's Dilemma and The Botany of Desire. He's professor of journalism at University of California at Berkeley. This year we are celebrating 30 years on the air of Focus by bringing back some of the oldest programs that we have in our archives, and we're planning on doing it again in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, you can let us know what you think by going to the Focus section of our webpage. So go to will.illinois.edu. Look for the place at the top of the page where we invite your comments on the show, and you can tell us what you think about these special archives, or maybe you have some comments about Focus, some memory, some particular show that stands out in your mind that you've heard over the last couple of decades, and we'd be very happy to hear from you if you do.